This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Enola Holmes and the Boy in Buttons by Nancy Springer. Narrated for you by Tamarin Payne. "Hello, Miss Meshel," cried Joddy, the boy in buttons who greeted me at the front door of Dr. Regarston's stately edifice. Blushing, he then babbled, "Excuse me, I mean, good day, Mrs. Jacobson." I had been known to him by those names, and more, during the year I was evading my brothers Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes, but those times were no more. "Both of those persons are as fictitious as Dr. Regarston himself, Joddy," I responded with a smile, handing him a bundle of new textbooks I was carrying done up in a strap. Accepting this in his usual lackwit manner, Joddy gawked up at me, for he had seldom seen me all summer. He probably did not understand what I meant by fictitious, nor did he quite know what to make of my sudden appearance in a blouse, a skirt, and a plain straw hat, the simple garb of a scholar.
"Would you care for tea, Mrs. Jacobson?" he ventured.
"You will observe that I need no longer disguise myself by wearing a wedding ring, Joddy," I replied with a smile as I stripped off my gloves. But I had always liked the boy, so I made myself stop teasing him. "I am here simply as myself from now on, and my real name is Enola Holmes. You may place the books on my desk. Yes, I would love some tea. Thank you." Seating myself in the desk chair, I took a deep breath of satisfaction, surveying my familiar small kingdom in the vestibule outside the double doors leading to the office of the great Dr. Leslie Regarston, Purgatorian, the fictitious finder of the lost whose business I, myself, had founded. But, at the moment, I intended to locate no missing persons. I came here simply because it was conveniently proximate to the Women's Academy where I was beginning my studies, whereas my lodgings at the Professional Women's Club were much farther away. This comfortable nook, in the boarding house I had bought with the money my mother had purloined for me, was perfectly situated to accommodate me between my morning and evening classes. I opened my textbook of geometry, and from a pocket in my skirt I drew forth my new toys, a compass and protractor. I anticipated that I would quite like geometry, for I loved to draw, and I was to learn a new way of drawing. I was delightedly making equilateral triangles within circles upon foolscap when Joddy returned with quite a fancy tea tray, wrought silver strainer full of loose tea leaves balanced on an exquisite cup and saucer with matching creamer and sugar bowl. Joddy poured, then settled the quilted cosy over the teapot to keep the water hot. From so much porcelain and such decorum, I deduced that my arrival had caused some excitement among the servants.
"Do ye require a fire, Miss Meshel?"
Joddy asked, as taut as a bird dog on point. "Miss Holmes," I corrected him. It felt so good to use my very own name. From now on and forevermore, I am Miss Holmes. No, I do not need a fire. It is not cold. And yes, I answered the unspoken question that was causing him, and doubtless the others backstairs, such anxiety. I shall be coming here every day for a while. His plump-cheeked young face relaxed. He was very nearly tricked into smiling. The next day I required a fire, for there was a sudden chill in the air. For a few days the weather continued thus, alternately balmy and frosty, and Joddy's nose started to run, to my annoyance, for he tended to wipe it on his sleeve. I had just purchased him a handkerchief when one day I arrived, but the boy in buttons was not Joddy. How very odd, for he wore Joddy's absurd uniform, Prussian blue jacket with big pearl buttons cheek to jowl in parade down the front, matching blue trousers with white piping down the sides, hat for all the world like a little blue cake with white trimming. For a horridly unsettling moment, I thought that someone had taken Joddy and somehow emaciated him overnight, for the uniform hung upon him as if on a skeleton, and his thin, thin face resembled Joddy's somehow. This boy in buttons ducked his head and blushed. I suppose I was staring at him.
"Paddy, Mom,"
he said to me, with a bobbing attempt at a bow after he had shut the door behind us.
"Joddy be unwell."
My mind groped for understanding. "Your name is Paddy?"
"Yes, Mom. I mean, yes, Miss Holmes."
His voice, like his body, was far thinner than Joddy's. "You are Joddy's brother?"
"A bit younger than him, yes'm."
"And you've come to take his place because he is sick?"
"Yes, Miss Holmes."
"Do you understand your duties?" How heartless of me, when I should have been inquiring as to the extent of Joddy's illness.
"Yes, ma'am," recited Paddy. "I am to sweep the pavement and the front steps and the like, tend the front door and polish the knob, look after the vestibule, fetch and carry."
By then, I had noticed that he had already lit the fire in the hearth by my desk, and I became more amiable. Graciously accepting his offer of tea, I settled at my desk and started exploring the mysteries of Phi, upon special paper printed all over with tiny squares. Being thus immersed all afternoon, I took no further notice of my boy in buttons until it was time for me to go. As he opened the door for me, I gave him a smile and a penny, saying, "You've done very well, but when you get home, please tell Joddy I hope he feels better soon." Paddy would leave later, after helping serve dinner to the lodgers. I spent a comfortable night in my room at the Professional Women's Club, a safe refuge where no men were allowed on the premises. Then, at the academy the next morning, some of my classmates made overtures of friendship, inviting me to take luncheon with them. So it was not until afternoon that, pleasantly anticipating a nap on the sofa, I approached Dr. Regarstin's office. On the front step of the stately house sat such a boy as I had seen many times in the East End, a street Arab, with bare feet, ragged knickers, and a thin, torn jacket, hapless, with his head on his knees, his shabby cap hiding his face. Such a young vagrant did not belong in my part of London. But as I hesitated before him, uncertain whether the cook would have hysterics if I brought him into the kitchen and gave him something to eat, he raised his head to face me, and I gasped. It was Joddy. Joddy, with wet, red eyes, his nose a fountain of greeny, yellow mucus.
"Joddy!"
I exclaimed.
"You should be home in bed!"
In a clotted voice, he inquired,
"Paddy?"
"Why, Paddy did quite well."
"But he didn't come home."
A pang seized me as I realised that Joddy's eyes were tearful and his voice thick, not just from illness, but from emotion. He was here on my doorstep, and he had been waiting for me all day to inquire about his brother.
"Paddy did not return home yesterday evening?"
I demanded rather stupidly, as he had just told me so.
"I can't find him anywhere."
Joddy spoke in the dull tone of one driven almost past tears to despair.
"Me mum is that upset."
Utterly shocked, I told him, "Wait here, I'll be back straight away." I lunged up the steps and through the door, flung my books on the floor and ran to the kitchen, where I seized cheese out of the crock and bread from the pantry, loading my pockets. Washing dishes without looking at me, the cook proclaimed,
"That young Paddy left here 8 o'clock yesterday evening, just like he was supposed to."
I plucked apples from a basket. The cook complained,
"I already told this one I don't know nothing about Paddy, and how dare he come here looking like a beggar?"
In all likelihood, I realised with a stab of dismay, Joddy wore the only clothes he owned, and had loaned Paddy his boots yesterday. How had I not realised he and his family were so poor? Snatching an extra shawl from a peg, I ran back outside. Joddy had started to sob in a weak, hiccuping way. I wrapped the shawl around him and gave him bread warm from the oven. "Come along," I told him, taking him by the elbow and coaxing him to his feet. My plan was to take him home, ascertain whether his brother had not yet reappeared, and then, if necessary, locate the wretched Paddy. Asking Joddy, "Where do you live?" I stood ready to hail a passing cab. The miserable boy mumbled something that sounded like, "Aldgate Pump." "Aldgate Pump!" I exclaimed. Sucking at the bread he held in both grubby hands, he nodded. "But Aldgate Pump was halfway across London. How did you get here?"
"Walked."
A 2-hour walk. Had he done it every day of his employment with me? Stunned by this revelation, I nearly let a cab drive by before I regained my wits, shot my arm out and stopped it with a shrill, most unladylike whistle.
"Blimey!"
said Joddy, gawking, as I all but lifted him into the cab. Once underway, I extracted paper and pencil from my bosom to draw a picture of the missing person, Paddy, whilst continuing to ply Joddy with food. Once we reached Aldgate Pump, we both drank the water flowing from the mouth of the big brass wolf head jutting out of a tall stone tower, surmounted by a wrought iron lamppost. This typically pompous monument to hygiene marked the edge of civilization, so to speak. Beyond lay the East End. I sopped a handkerchief in the pump water and sacrificed it entirely in an effort to clean Joddy's face. He was so low in spirits that he did not resist me, but I think the cold water refreshed him somewhat. "Which way?" I asked, looking around at a spiderweb of narrow streets all swirling with the usual hurly-burly of the poor. Hatless women shouting from doorsteps at tattered, quarrelling children, vendors hawking their goods from donkey carts, bored men advertising, humanity aplenty, but I saw no sign of poor Paddy. Silently, Joddy led me down one of the crowded roads, pushing past a rat catcher with full cages, who stood talking with two men leading black and tan terriers on leashes, bargaining for the use of his rats. Most ladies, I am sure, would have wanted to stop their eyes and ears at the sight of such depravity, but I relished the brawling life of lower-class London. Barefoot girls selling matches or sardines or nosegays, blind beggars, tinkers pounding away to mend battered pots, rag-and-bone pickers.
"You lovely lady in a spanking new straw hat!"
bellowed someone at me, a man just behind me. I turned to give him a chilling stare, but my mouth dropped open when I saw him. An ordinary enough chap, but he wore a top hat with mother-of-pearl buttons sewed cheek to jowl all over it. Also, pearl buttons covered his jacket collar and decorated his shoulders.
"Kind lady, would you care to spare a penny for the orphans?"
he asked civilly enough. I stood speechless. Tugging at my sleeve, Joddy said in tones muffled by mucus,
"It's just Henry Croft,"
as if that explained anything.
"Raised in an orphanage, I were,"
explained Henry Croft. Rows of pearl buttons shimmered down his sleeves, around his cuffs, and down the sides of his trousers, I saw now.
"Orphans?" I inquired. "Or might the penny perhaps go to purchase more buttons?"
"Oh no, my lady. People be so careless, I find them dropped in the street wherever I goes,"
he said with the fervour of a true button believer.
"I gets up early, and why, just this morning, I found these all in a heap outside a public house."
As he spoke, he reached into his trousers pocket to show me a handful of perfect penny-sized white buttons. Now, I must admit that Joddy recognised them first. His hand shot up, and he gave a wordless bleat. But at almost the same moment, I demanded of the odd Croft man,
"Wait, all in a heap? How many?"
"Why, I didn't rightly count."
He began to do so. Much whiter than the cheap ones made of oyster shell that decorated his clothing, these buttons were cut from fine abalone, and instead of holes drilled in them, they had shanks. Even before he concluded,
19.
I felt quite sure. Yes, 19 exactly. I had always wondered why it wasn't 20. These were the buttons from the uniform of a certain boy in buttons now missing. I reached into a pocket of my own and produced money. Looking just Henry Croft straight in the eye, I told him,
"I will give you far more than a penny for your orphans if you will take me to where you found these."
His eyes widened, his mouth gaped. I had him hooked like a great fish. "We had better take Joddy home first," I added. And that wretched boy did not even protest. Eyes swollen and crusted with dried tears, nose even more unsightly, he truly belonged in his bed. His home, as it turned out, was nearby. His mother, a frantic sort of frizzy-headed hen, met us at the door of the single shoddy tenement room, clung to Joddy and confirmed that Paddy had not reappeared. Two more children huddled in the folds of her skirt. I gave them all of the food that remained in my pockets and saw Joddy nestle among quilts piled in a corner before I left, memorising the location, knowing I must return with help and, it was greatly to be hoped, with Paddy.
"Now then, this way,"
said Henry Croft, striding off at a good clip. As I am regrettably, for a female, long of limb, I had no trouble keeping up with him, and as we walked through the narrow streets, he talked profusely. His top hat covered with buttons, he explained, was just the beginning of his ambition. He wanted eventually to have a proper suit with tails all covered with pearl buttons. Costermongers in their flash boy outfits, with buttons on their pocket flaps and the fronts of their caps, would look like pearly paupers compared to him. He found buttons in his employment as a street sweeper and also in the back of the paper mill where buttons were cut off rags and just left there.
"What a waste," he lamented. "They..."
Crassly, I interrupted. "Are you not curious about those 19 buttons in your pocket? This boy is missing." Pulling it from a pocket, I showed him the likeness I had drawn of Paddy wearing the pageboy uniform, closely spaced buttons running down the front of the jacket. "Why would anyone take my pageboy and cut his buttons off?"
"Dunno, lady,"
he answered, only dimly interested in anything but himself.
"Skinny lad,"
he added after I pressed him with silence.
"Looks like a pipe cleaner with eyes."
I sighed. "Let me assure you, gentle reader, that my pencil renditions of persons are quite competent and accurate. However, this man was obtuse, so I merely asked, how much farther?"
"Just around the next corner."
Which was occupied, I saw, by a dolly shop, the cheapest sort of pawn shop, dealing in pots and tinware. A few strides farther on, Henry Croft said,
"Right here,"
pointing at a trampled patch of unpaved street between a tap room and a doss house. "Walk on," I told him, because many eyes were watching. In that warren, I, in my clean and whole clothing, was nearly as much of a spectacle as was he. But once around the next corner, I stopped him, paid him handsomely, and off he went, tipping his preposterous pearly hat at me, quite content to leave me amid a boiling broth of unwashed humanity, all of it hungry for supper, as the sun was lowering. If one could see it behind the pall of smoke, which one could not. A long-aproned baker selling jam tarts balanced a tray above his head with one hand and rang a bell with the other.
"Hot eels! Ginger beer! Rabbit pie!"
yelled street vendors lined up along the curb. Tatterdemalion folk jostled from one dubious source of nutrition to another. Barefoot children chased each other everywhere. With my drawing of Paddy in hand, I looked around me. I was a well-dressed stranger here, and people would be none too friendly. In such cases, experience had taught me, information would be best obtained from children and drunkards. There would be plenty of drunken men later on. Meanwhile, I approached a ragged girl selling pears from a basket. "Do you know this boy?" I asked as I purchased a pear for a farthing. She looked quite blank. "Have you ever seen him?" She shook her head. And so did the next several children, and the jam tart man, and an oyster seller, and sundry others as I wended my way along the street, feeling suspicion like an invisible wall between the denizens and me, but less so with the children. Munching my pear, I showed the picture to a pudding-faced boy leading a toddler by the hand. The boy shook his head, but the baby pointed a wee finger and screamed,
"That's Buster's new nightman!"
"Hush you!"
The boy turned on the little one, but I forestalled him by handing him the remains of my pear. "Where does this Buster live?" I demanded. Pear already in his mouth, the boy muttered,
"The Ollie and Trossel."
The what? Ollie and Hostel? And what in heaven's name was a nake man? Still, I was ahead of where I had been. Buster, nake man, Ollie or something. Now, somehow, I had to find Paddy. Turning around but trying to look aimless, I walked back toward the place Henry Croft had shown me, where the Buttons had been. I found that narrow street just as crowded as any other. Folk shied away from me only slightly as I wended my way to the location I sought by the Doss House and the tap room, alert for elucidation of any sort. Might the Doss House, a very primitive sort of inn renting out a patch of floor to sleep on, be considered a hostel? But who was Ollie? I scowled at the crude sign over the taproom door, an advertisement badly in need of repainting, depicting some kind of speckled bird surrounded by a wreath of peculiarly prickly leaves with red dots on them. Oh, for mercy's sake! Holly! Holly and what? Robin? Thrush? Throstle. The taproom was called the Holly and Throstle. I erased any person named Ollie from my mind and concentrated instead on locating the Buster person who supposedly lived there. It would cause a scene of consternation if I, an upper-class female, were to set foot in the Doss House or the tap room, but after consideration I went across the street and entered the Dolly Shop, a dim little den piled high with battered tinware, everything from tumblers to an enormous spidery bronchitis kettle, a wooden laundry rack hung with tea balls and glass trinkets, and assorted earthenware bowls, bent forks, balls of string, all kinds of oddments. The proprietor was an oddment as well, a stunted, hollow-chested man wearing a red fez and matching smoking jacket, both quite mangy, with black astrakhan trim. He peered at me without smile or greeting when I came in, much as if he had been just about to close for the day, but I knew how to make him amiable. I seized at once upon a pudding mould and brightly asked, "How much is this? And do you have any fish tongs?" Eagerly browsing his motley wares, I accepted every price he named, and as my purchases accrued, so did his willingness to answer my questions. What sort of neighbours lived across the way? Were there many beggars because of the Doss House? Was the taproom noisy? Who owned it? Someone named Buster? He laughed in an odd way.
"Oh, there's a Buster in it all right, but he don't own nothing in a proper sense. A regular sneakin' crib cracker he is."
Really? So Buster was not a name. Buster was an occupation, that of burglar. How would I find him? His eyebrows shot up so that they nearly knocked his fez off his head.
"Whatever for, lady?"
"I believe he has something I want back." With real concern on his rickety face, he expostulated,
"Lady, you don't want to tangle with Black Billy. He don't..."
"Black Billy?" I interrupted in quest of a physical description. "Why is he called that? Black hair?"
"Bald head and a black heart. He'll spit in your face as soon as talk with you, big bully of a crimping prig."
"A tall man?" I interrupted again, having no idea what a crimping prig was.
"Tall? He's a giant. He'll break you in half. But you won't see him in daylight. He comes out by night."
Then, with the haste and decision of one who feels he has talked too much,
"Will there be anything else, lady?"
As there was nothing more to be got out of him, I paid for my purchases, bundled them into a string bag, everything packed nicely within the pudding mould, and departed both the Dolly Shop and the vicinity of the Holly and Throstle. Already the lamps were being lit, and I needed to find a change of clothes before I could put my plan into action. My skirt was dark enough, but my blouse was unfortunately white, and although I wore a shawl, I could not entirely cover it. However, under the eaves of someone's hovel a couple of streets away, I spied a big, shabby black jacket on a washing line, and I appropriated it, leaving my entire string bag of tinware in exchange. I also left my hat, putting my shawl over my head instead. Feeling only slightly guilty, I made my way back to the Holly and Throstle, approaching from the rear to slink into the narrow, dark passageway between the tap room and the Doss House. And there, in the shadows where I could watch all who came and went, I waited. I knew I would have to wait for hours and hours, so at first, while there were many folks still on the street, I made myself approximately comfortable on the ground with my shoulders against one building and my knees against the other, and I ordered myself to rest. In this cramped way I dozed, But as soon as the children had come to lead their drunken fathers home from the taproom and the night became more silent, I gladly extricated myself and stood up to watch and listen. Now and then a midden picker passed, or some night soilmen, all trudging in the same direction, toward the city where their betters lived, to take away their stinking waste while they slept. But I was waiting for someone who wanted to take something else from the rich, and the wait was long. There was no obliging clock nearby to strike the hours, but I am sure it must have been well past midnight when finally I heard a door open and close, then footsteps. Past me strode a good-sized man with a dark lantern in one hand. I could smell hot metal, and a firm grip on the arm of a very thin boy with the other. In that ill-lit street, the man was merely a looming shadow to me, but some stray streetlight beam showed me a gleam of white piping up the sides of the child's trousers. Indeed, as I had thought and hoped, it was Paddy, still wearing his boy in buttons uniform, minus the buttons. His tousled head was bare. Someone had stolen his absurd little cake of a hat, but the man wore a shapeless cap. Once Buster and Paddy were safely past, I slipped out of my hiding place and followed them. Not the simplest thing to do, as I had to keep a safe distance, yet not lose them in the dark. Luckily, I'd had much practice sneaking around London at night. Also luckily, Paddy made considerable noise, as he was being hauled along more than lead. His feet scraped as he scrambled to keep up, and he started to whimper. The big brute who had him growled,
"Hush your yammering, or I'll make you dead instead of making you my snake man."
Not snake man, snake man. Snake man? What on earth? Black Billy gave Paddy a shake.
"Stop your whinging,"
he warned with so much menace in his low voice that it chilled me and silenced Paddy at once. He remained mute as his captor led him into the city and up the broad avenues of a wealthy neighbourhood, where houses like so many mansions sat cheek to jowl. Still trailing behind them, I kept my distance until the Buster ducked between two of the tall and stately homes, but then I ran on tiptoe to catch up, venturing quite close to them in the utter darkness between buildings, mouth open to silence my breathing so that I could hear theirs. And I could hear small sounds of movement and smell the dark lantern. There was a faint metallic sound as Black Billy set it down, and I flattened myself against the wall. He slid the lantern open on one side only, and there he stood, luckily with his back to me, not 10 feet away. And there beside him stood poor, trembling Paddy in front of a bevelled glass window behind ornate iron bars. Black Billy picked him up by the waist and set his feet on the windowsill. Paddy grabbed the bars and started to writhe his thin, thin body between them. Like a snake. No wonder they had cut off his buttons. They would have made a tremendous racket on the cast iron. His appointed task, I surmised, was to slither through the bars, open the window, and then slip into the house and unlock a door from the inside for Black Billy. Almost before I finished thinking this, I moved with great velocity to do 5 things nearly simultaneously. I threw my shawl over Black Billy's ugly head, blanketing him to his waist, and gave him a hard shove to send him staggering. I said, "Paddy, it's Enola," and took hold of the poor boy, pulling him out of the window. With a clatter, I kicked the lantern over to create total darkness. I whistled fit to summon a constable. And, thing number 5, tucking Paddy under one arm and hoisting my skirt with the other hand, I ran. Out the way we had come in and then down the street, I sprinted. I am a splendid runner, if I do say so myself, and I love doing it. Once I was certain we had left Black Billy well and truly behind, I found myself laughing with glee. Once I finally stopped running, I paused for breath and set Paddy on his feet.
"Miss Meshel, Jacobson, Holmes," he bleated.
"Yes, let us get you home."
"Miss Mesh, Jacobson, Holmes,"
I questioned him, trying to ascertain whether he was hurt or hungry or both, but he seemed incapable of any more sensible utterance. So I offered my hand, but he latched onto my skirt, and we walked off at a hampered pace. Silent, Paddy dragged his feet, so evidently done in that I picked him up again and carried him in my arms. He laid his head on my shoulder and slept. This slowed me down considerably, so that by the time we reached Oldgate Pump, it was already dawn and folk were up and about. Feeling a bit done in, I set Paddy on the curb, laboured to pump the great handle, then bent to wash my face and hands in the resultant gush of water. After a moment, Paddy got up and did the same. Then, still mute, as if tugged by a kind of inward gravitational force, he trudged toward his home. I tarried a little to make various purchases from hucksters heading for market, so I missed seeing the reunion of mother and child. When I reached the tenement room, I found Paddy and Joddy and their mother and the other children all in a single tearful embrace, so that I slipped in unnoticed with my arms full of bread and pears and meat pies and the like, leaving them on the bare table and turning to go before anyone noticed. But Joddy saw.
Miss Meshel!
He yelped, ricocheting toward me. Miss Enola Holmes, I corrected gently, standing very erect and proper to keep him from embarrassing himself by embracing me. Joddy, I see you still have a dreadful cold. You and Paddy must both take time off until I can have a new uniform made up, but I have not yet paid either of you. I pressed a generous sum of money into his hands, then at once took my leave. Perhaps an hour later, safe in my much superior lodging, I sank gratefully into my comfortable bed, feeling quite entitled to miss my classes for the day. But I could not immediately sleep, for my mind was busy with thoughts of Paddy, Joddy and Paddy. Purchase two new uniforms, hire them both, raise their pay to feed the family, see to it that they got some education. This is Tamarin Payne. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Enola Holmes and the Boy in Buttons, a Macmillan audio production for Wednesday Books. This title was produced by Guy Oldfield. Text copyright 2021 by Nancy Springer. Production copyright 2021 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.